outside right now.
Well.
We're going to give a few more minutes.
And that tells you the talking points.
That particular.
All right, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. We have critical mass. Bev Ledford contacted me and said she's going to try to call in. Unfortunately, she's attending a service today, and then I haven't heard from the others. Why don't we go ahead and run down who all's here so we have it for the minute. Jay, do you want to start?
Jay Ford.
Becky Coobin.
Ann Galavan.
AJ Orskin.
Russ Perkinson.
Kim Husky.
Mike Osterling.
Rob O'Reilly.
Andrew Button.
Ellen Boland.
Ken Stack.
Tony Watkins.
Excellent. So today we're going to cover a couple of things. We're going to start with reviewing the regulation on the renewal fee. And we previously circulated a version of that. It has been changed. Not like the fundamental part of it, which is the $150 fee, is not changed. But in order to meet the sort of structure of a regulation and a few other nuances, we have provided some adjustments. So if you guys haven't had a chance to look at that yet, which I imagine you haven't because you literally just put it in front of you, I'm going to give you guys just a few minutes to review that, and then we can talk about it.
Says mostly the same things. It's been moved around a little bit and tweaked. It did go before our regulatory review committee meeting members this morning, so it got kind of rewritten again.
You picked up on the non-refundable one. That was missing in the first one.
Yes, it was. Yeah,
it was.
Picked up on that.
We're just going through we gave a new draft of the regulation for the renewal fee, and so everybody's just taking a minute to review it. So there should be a copy there.
Yeah.
see a few people still reading. We're going to give it maybe another minute or so. Most people have probably done reading the draft regulation, and then for the purposes of the minutes, Tommy Leggett has joined us. All right, so we're just going to run through really quickly what we have here, why we have it. Preamble is just sort of telling us why we're here. The purpose, again, is we are meeting the requirements of the law and establishing a renewal fee. Definitions are pretty straightforward. I think where it probably gets more interesting for everybody is 1350. So we talk about the form, the fee, and the denial. So Section A is just laying out what their requirements. You're required to submit a lease application and a fee. What you're requiring to do, and then that we shall be sending the renewal by both regular mail and certified mail approximately 2 months prior. The regular mail and the certified mail is in direct response to some of the issues this committee raised, ensuring that people get the notification and that we're covered on that. Fee states non-refundable fee for the renewal of Oyster Grounds shall be submitted with the form and shall be received received or postmarked on or before the current 10-year date. And that was to get at the idea of someone can bring in their renewal, and that's the received, but it has to be postmarked before the thing. We debated about whether or not it needed to be received here at MRC versus just postmarked. We are still struggling with some of the mail and transferring from the other building, and so really wanted to set the bright line of it being postmarked, and that would be a little bit easier. And then just clarifying, the review is based on 28.2613, as well as regulations or guidance as approved by the commission. And that is what this committee will also take up after we finish this. But unless it's approved by the commission, we'll continue to review it according to the guidelines set out in the code. And then clarifying again that failure to meet use or production requirements or failure to return the completed form and fee by the expiration date shall constitute denial of lease renewal. Previously, we just had failure to return completed form and fee, and we wanted to be explicit that you're being reviewed on two criteria. One, the ability to get the form in on time, and two, really, the production and use requirements. So, thoughts, concerns, comments?
What's the cost of certified mail for each of these things?
I believe it's $6.
We're contemplating the $150 fee will cover that, so we will just send it certified. The agency will absorb that cost.
But that $150 fee goes to the general fund, right?
Yes.
So it's not really covering the certified mail cost.
Nope. We could add that cost into the regulation and make the person pay it. But
no, I think we're paying enough. I don't need any more fees.
This is per lease, so we're not going to have a renewal. If we have multiple renewals, it would be multiple times.
Correct. It is per lease per the law. Yeah.
So how long before y'all are going to realize that $6 certified fee is kind of expensive and you're going to come back and say, we've got to get another fee on you guys to cover this?
I can't answer that.
That's not the plan at the time. Our goal is to make sure the $6 fee actually solves some work at our end and sort of provides a bit of, I hate to use it, cover for us that we can say we mailed this and you got it. and it takes away the excuse of I never got this, I didn't see it. And so the $6 fee in certified mail was actually an idea that Ben had really before we started talking about this fee. So I don't foresee us coming back to collect it. I think for us it's the cost of doing business. But I can speak for this administration alone, the commissioner.
And I sort of factored that into potentially when I was doing what it would cost to do this, including the review and everything. You know, I factored in putting the piece of paper that the forms on, the mailing it through regular mail, and then if we added this in, and we presented that to y'all, and you know, the cost was actually a little less than 150, but there was that unknown number that we would have to follow up on and would eat up a lot of staff time. So by the committee, we sort of came to 150 seems like a reasonable fee, and it would cover our costs.
And I apologize if you're repeating stuff. I couldn't make it last month. I had vehicle troubles and couldn't get it. So.
But you are right. Right now, the $150 does go back to the general fund. So, but the law still states that we are required to set a fee that reflects the costs of us. So,
is there a reason we're not doing this on email or online? I mean, all the leases are online. You can search leases. You can get all the coordinates of the corners. You can get, you know, all the information. Why are we maybe not posting something that leases are coming up for renewal?
So that's a good question. We are, as an agency more broadly, looking to take more of our services online. Right now we're working with IT to develop an online system for habitat permits. To be able to start there, both by paying the habitat permit as well as getting an electronic signature for it, to go away from the notaries on both ends. So, more broadly, the agency is looking to move to electronic service providing, but that we're not there yet with Oysters. But it is something that we can do. The reg is specifically written that if we wanted to move to electronic at some point, we can. This doesn't preclude moving electronically. But right now, we are looking at habitat. I think we're looking at some Oyster things next, but it's probably, to take most of our services electronic, we're probably at like an 18-month to 3-year horizon.
And this came up today in the Regulatory Review Committee. Our IT person said, well, it says regular mail or certified mail. And he said, what about email? And I said, yeah, it would be good eventually, but we don't have a way to collect the fee yet either electronically.
But some of those leaseholders are not going to have email, believe it or not.
Well, yeah. We'll have to do some mail because we don't have an email address, so there's no choice. But
yeah, I mean, regular mail and certified mail seem a little bit redundant, but whatever.
I mean, for the sort of breadth of constituents we deal with, MRC is always going to offer the mail or the cash option. But for those people who the email option would be for something that people could opt into, but we'll always have to offer mail.
No, what you could consider doing if you want to have that option in the future, mm-hmm. kind of as an option for people, is instead of shall, use may, you know, that the commission may offer you know, some email notification. I think you'd still have to do the mail and certified mm-hmm. mail, but you know, people might get it sooner. Maybe you could send it out email 2 weeks before you send the mailing, and if they get it back to you, you're okay, mm-hmm. but you could just add a sentence saying that gives you authority in the future to do it without reopening regulation.
Yeah. Okay.
I think our hope was that we're moving pretty rapidly. The habitat thing came together pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be implemented, I think, relatively soon. And Worship Ground will be next, that when we add email to this regulation, which I think we'd have to go back and say we're going to do email or may do the email, that we'd have the ability for the person to send a fee in electronically at the same time. Because still they're going to, right now, if we email them, they have to mail us the payment. And we're going to say, unless we got the form and the payment by the deadline, we don't have both of them, then we're going to revert your lease. So somebody might email us back right away and then forget to write the check. So I think it's coming, and it's coming pretty soon, but it's not quite there yet.
But you could go on and write the authority in. You know, may doesn't force the commission ever to do it, but it gives you, if it's in there, you can do it when you want to and when you're capable. So
sure.
Just a thought.
Okay. Yep. We can take a look at that. Any other
I can't remember, but I think in the code, the lease is not just renew or deny. There's also a modify.
None of us have it.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Actually,
I usually bring a book and I don't have it. But if that's the case, then the part about the formal hearing to appeal would be for the denial or the modification.
I don't see modify.
I don't think it did that.
Okay.
There was a lot of discussion that it was, but I don't think it did.
Okay.
No.
I had this discussion recently.
Not renewed.
Transfer. We can certainly modify.
Okay, that's what it was. Yeah, you're right.
But a renewal, it just says the commissioner shall renew or not renew.
It says renew or extend.
Or extend.
Which needs another 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder why it says, shall not renew or extend.
Right. Yeah. Or significant production or significant.
Of course, you could tell the applicant, I mean, if it was a marginal case, you could tell them, you know, what the thought is, we're not going to renew this one, you know, unless you're willing to do such and such. But, I mean, that's a lot of trouble on y'all, but it would give you some flexibility.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Comments. I mean, the big issue is the $150. Are there any things we're missing that you all feel like we should include?
I got a more question of language in here under C. It says, all lease use or production requirements. Would that encompass things like what's in 4VAC 20, 335, 30? It talks about production methods and no new structures on existing SAV, that sort of thing. Would that phraseology within C cover that sort of thing?
Well, I think 1205 was already in 613, a reference to 1205. So,
yeah,
an SAV is one of the things that's in 1205 that we would consider. We do consider it now. I consider that when I look at renewals now, I look at the SAV and see if the lease has a lot of SAV in it.
I was just reading where it says contained within either regulation or guidance. So, that's a regulation, I guess, an existing one. So, that's my question, if it encompassed that or not.
I don't know if that had come up in our if that had come up in our conversations. It's something we can take a look at.
We'll have to look at that regulation.
Yeah.
So how do you notify them if it's been denied? Because you have a 60-day time frame from the date of denial. Is there some sort of written?
You send a letter out that says your lease has been terminated or denied. Date of that letter is what I would say was the date of the decision. I don't know, 60 days from that date.
Okay.
I have a bit of, I don't know if it's a question or a comment. I think I brought it up before, but this process is subjective. Renewal is subjective according to staff when this comes in. Now, information can be provided to staff as required, but ultimately, the decision is staff to renew or deny the lease. Assuming the fees paid now, met all the other standards. Is there any deference given to businesses that have multiple leases for a number of renewals, previous renewals, is considered different than somebody that does not have a history of production or maybe an active member of the industry?
I think the answer is no. It depends on what you put down. If you put that down on the form for this particular lease, it's why you're not using it to its full extent or why you don't have any production or Yeah, I think, and you're right, it's subjective because every one is different. It's amazing the different things I get on the renewal form.
I guess maybe,
I don't understand why you think just because it's an industry lease that I should just think it should be renewed if there's no activity on it.
Well, I think what I'm going back to is maybe a discussion that we had in that work group, the secretary's work group, and I can't remember exactly who it was, but we had a discussion around, I have a bundle, a number of leases, and some are used, as we've discussed, as nursery seed, some are grow out, some are fallow, some are buffer, some are, you know, whatever they might be used as. And if I have productivity documented as mandatory reporting, let's say, then all those leases should be renewed. That was the discussion back at the policy work group. We obviously haven't captured that in here because this is lease by lease that
right.
You're renewing. So, anyways, I think it's going to be difficult to capture in here. That's why I said it's maybe more of a comment than a question.
Well,
but I think
back on. Let's get done with this first because this is really just about the fee.
Right.
And the framework of what we'll look at. We'll look at 613, and we'll look at any current, maybe, or future regulations the commission passes. And that's the next thing we're going to talk about today is, you know, how do we do that? How do we do the 10-year new? What should be considered? I think that's coming.
That's coming. That's the next thing we're going to do.
Okay. All right.
We're going to wanted to close out the renewal fee specifically. What will follow this will is a broader conversation about beneficial use that will inform both renewal criteria, which will likely be in a guideline, as well as anything involving better understanding how the prop or the lease will be used around lease applications. So that's next. But for this, we just wanted to nail down that we sort of tick the boxes of non-refundable, the criteria that you can have for denial, and then setting in regulation the $150 fee. So, did you have something to add, Jay?
I know I asked this question last time, but what are you looking for from us? Are you looking for an upvote, downvote, or everyone just say?
I mean, I think sort of what we said last time was we look to you all as advisors. Ultimately, it's the commission staff that has to make a recommendation to the commission. But if you have any additional comments or thoughts or stand in strong opposition, please let us know now. And if not, we will move the forward regulation forward and ask the commission for a hearing on it.
But don't stand up at the commission hearing and oppose it.
If you could not do that, that would be great. Let me walk that statement back real fast.
Yeah.
If you oppose it, please let us know. But if it's just silence or we previously had your support stand at the commission and say you oppose it, well, that would be less than desirable, put it that way. All right.
I don't plan on opposing it, but I want to be clear about what I said before, that there has been precedent set at this commission that you could put multiple leases on an application, on a transfer, and I think that system would be beneficial for this renewal process. I don't think it happens often because you said lease by lease, but if you happen to have a number of leases that would renew at the same time, I don't know if that's the case or not. I think there should be an opportunity on that form to have multiple leases renew at the same time. They'd be reviewed by criteria separately. But for the $150, which again is, I understand, over 10 years, and I understand it's a nominal fee, right? I get it. It could have been up to $300. But this is something that didn't have a fee before. So we just went through an application fee increase, just went through a transfer increase. So I won't stand up and oppose it, but I just want to be clear that that's my comment.
Hey, Jay, are you suggesting that multiple leases on one renewal form would only require $150 fee?
Yeah. If your leases don't renew at the same time, then it's kind of a moot point. But if there are cases like that, then...
I'll give you an example, and I won't tell you who it is. But I had four that came in all at the same time. This will all take effect. And two of them had lots of production. Two of them had no production.
and on the form was a sticky note saying, here's my total harvest on these leases. Please consider them combined. This is that scenario you're giving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are all part of me. But they didn't really hit the threshold on the two, in my opinion. They said to use 0% of the lease to start with, okay? That's a red flag for me right off the bat. You better explain that. And they made an explanation, but didn't really cut it. I sent them the letter saying it was going to be denied. We had a conversation. They said, oh, well, also this and this and this. Yeah. And I don't think it was a lie. What they told me was that, well, I should have put on that. He said that these are backups, you know, if something happens to one of the others. And we renewed them, okay?
Understood, and so, good example. You know, I think, following on my previous point of, I would look at the name of the business or the leaseholder of the company that was behind that maybe and say, oh, I understand that they do have productivity on our leases. Maybe this is part of a business plan. Maybe this is a strategy. Now, they should have articulated that, I agree, in some way. But anyways, I appreciate the example. I understand.
I'm just also going to add that Mark Lugenbach has joined us for the purposes of the minutes. I'm going to do Russ and Jay. And before we're getting into more of the – actually, we are getting more beneficial use in determining how leases are best used. I don't have my folder in front of me. I'm going to blame Monday. But we'd have to look back at the law because the new transfer law specifically says each transfer. And so I believe for the lease it's the same of each lease. So we may be limited by the code in terms of being able to group those. But we can circle back on this. But for the purposes of the $150 renewal fee today, I don't think we can sort of look at that at the moment, but it could come up under it. The way I really see it coming up is maybe not in being able to combine the fee, but as we look at beneficial use, being able to look to the sort of the aggregate of the leases that you own as we assess different leases. Russ and then Jay.
Yeah, with that, I'll withdraw most of what I was going to say, but I do think if you get into consideration of other leases, they ought to at least be in proximity area-wise to each other instead of across the bay or something like that.
Jay?
I thought we came to this $150 number based on the cost it would take to assess a singular lease.
We did.
Okay. I feel like we can't really go too far afoul of that then if we're looking at if that's what our guidance is going to be here. If we start grouping them together, then I think we'd have to take another look at the fee itself.
Okay. Mark?
The legislation, which I have a copy of up here, does say for each lease.
Okay. There you go. So as we close this out, I think I am going to ask for a vote or a show of hands in terms of who is in broad, does not preclude you from commenting at the commission meeting, but a support of the draft regulation as it stands now. If you get a show of support of who's in support of it. 1, 2, 3, 2, 4, 6, so 7 in opposition?
It's not opposition.
And just abstaining.
Yeah. I can live with it. I've got some that I've stated before, some concerns that appears with the appearance, whether I don't think it's the intent, but the appearance to try and push some of the smaller producers out with the fee, maybe when the production is more of a better way to go. But that's and then, you know, clarification about the thing I asked for in B's. But
okay.
Other than that, you know, no concerns.
Okay. All right. The next steps for this is I need to check. We're possibly going to take this forward and ask at the next commission meeting, which is June 25th, and ask for a request for a public hearing. The date we have on this in terms of effect is, I believe, September 1st. So that is our goal, to try to get this in place September 1st. Kim?
Can you renew a lease before the 10-year period?
Excellent question. Ben?
If one comes in, well, I mean, not like 6 years before 10 years.
It didn't come before 10 years.
But when we send the form out 3 months in advance, right now, it would go to 2 months under this. If you send it back the next week, I'll renew it right then.
So let me clarify my question.
And the renewal is 10 years added on to the previous expiration, no matter when I renew it.
You can't renew it 6 years.
I don't
7 years, 8 years, 9 years.
That's a question, but I don't think the code contemplates that.
For small growers, just asking.
Why would you think somebody would want to do that?
Avoid
change the fee. If this goes into effect September 1.
Well, we only got 2 months left. And you didn't note that this says September 1.
Yes.
So we were shooting for July meeting. But the three month letters forms have already gone out using the language of the old law up until August.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel it was fair to implement this fee and everything on somebody that they've already gotten the form under the whole law.
Oh, sure.
You
know,
using the new law criteria to review it.
Totally agree.
Right. So at least give a month lag in there. So by September, the letters will all say new language, must get this back in by the deadline.
I don't think it's ever come up because it's never needed to come up before, so I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
It's a question we can ask an attorney, probably.
Not that big.
You might want to do that because I can see some of the smaller people who know this is in the mill going, I want to avoid the first $150.
Yep.
And ask for a renewal for 5-6 years in advance.
I think our system is not set up to do it.
Probably not.
Our database is not set up to even do that. So we have to change something.
Yeah. Doesn't the code talk about renewal on expiration or as it expires?
Right, upon expiration of the, yes, it does.
Okay.
So the code says each assignment of general oyster planting ground shall continue in force for 10 years from the date of assignment, unless the assignment is terminated. And then it says, however, assignments between 76 and 80 shall continue in force for 20 years from the date of assignment. There's a moot point now, but it's a good question.
Halfway around it, had you known a fee was coming, would have been to transfer the ground. The code clearly says now you can't do that either. I have to review your lease first, and if I'm not going to renew it, you can't transfer it.
Right.
So,
and that fee's higher.
Right. It also does say upon expiration. So
I guess we
can't skirt the $150.
All right.
We'll try, though.
Okay. So the next part of today's conversation is sort of getting at some of the thornier issues, which has how we establish criteria for lease renewal and how the commission and staff more broadly determines beneficial use. And there's a couple of ways to think about this, sort of starting under the framework of the 10-year renewal guidelines in terms of propagation and harvest of shellfish. All of this credit is due, to be honest, pull together a list that goes through just some of the sort of the brainstorm of ideas that he had of what we could consider under renewal. Andrew, can you pass that out for me? And as we go through that, Bev Ludford sent me comments because she couldn't attend. She's going to try to call in, but I wanted to read this into the minutes from her. She says, quote, I want to be clear that my recommendation on beneficial use is straightforward. Any activity that propagates oysters is, in my opinion, beneficial use. I consider myself a farmer and an oyster restorer. I do not believe this is subjective. I do not support quantitative measures because this would require too many variables to be considered and too much verification, which would be impossible with current resources. Either you submit your documentation that you are using the bottom for oyster propagation or not. If the staff of MRC recommends more information, I recommend a face-to-face meeting prior to a decision being made. And she did say that she supports the draft regulation regarding the lease renewal procedure and the non-refundable fee of $150. So I technically add her to the list. So as we look at lease renewal in particular, the way it was coming up as we were having conversations internally was sort of the first question is, does this activity sort of meet the spirit and the letter of the law and the regulations for beneficial use of oyster ground? And is that activity sufficient? So, you know, if you are planting oysters, that meets the criteria. Did you plant enough? If you harvested, did you do it enough? And so that was the initial frame that staff was using. In terms of the goal for the conversation today, I have two questions for you all. One is just to help us sort of define some of the things that we could look at when we look for renewal criteria. And the other question is a little different. One of the things we consistently hear is that there are bad actors around oyster grounds. What would be really helpful for us is to hear you all define what a bad actor is. Like, what activities specifically are you trying to get at? And that will also help us determine how we can define beneficial use, where we are ensuring that the bottom is being used to the highest and best use. So those are the two things that I'd like to get done today. I don't think, also just expectations, I don't think we're coming to any conclusions today. I don't think we're going to get really anything close to conclusions. This is just a chance to get a bunch of ideas from you all as we go back and try to develop this, nail this to the ground, to be able to present a draft of something in the next meeting or two. But I do believe it's going to be one of the harder things this committee and staff tackles. So just appreciate your openness and your willingness to think about this with us, and sort of some comfort in the fact that this is going to be a little bit squishy for a while. So I'm going to pause there and would love to hear from you all. I can start with a bad actor question. It would be great to hear from you all what a bad actor looks like to you.
I think one example of a bad actor, I got two of them right now, one in front of my house in the creek and another in a creek that I work in. And I think they're both people that do not want to see commercial activity in front of their home. And one recently got a lease in Perrin River. No intention of using that ground. I don't know how he got it or what he put down for getting it. He staked off the creek. He's got poles in the middle of the creek. He's got a $1 million home, lives in Northern Virginia, and he's just leasing up the ground to keep somebody else from doing it. Not that I wanted it. I don't want any more.
Okay.
But this kind of activity has been running rampant in York River since Danny Baco stirred things up way back when. And another example in Sarah Creek, people are doing that. So that's one example of a bad actor. I don't think they have any intention of using the ground. They're just trying to protect their shoreline.
Are their poles properly placed?
Excuse me?
Are their poles properly
placed? Oh, yeah, VMRC, or they, they've just got the periphery for now. Yeah, that's just when they surveyed it.
Okay. Mike?
I consider them bad upland property owners. Not bad actors in the industry.
Okay.
Industry bad actors are the people that, to me, will come in and lease up a little sliver of ground between your lease and the shoreline because maybe the shoreline has changed. And they have no intention of planting that, but they want to use it to access your grounds. So I see people leasing to poach.
Mm.
And that's a concern that industry has, because if they lease to poach, they're going to poach off your ground, and then they're going to report that landing from their ground, and you're going to get false documentation that they're using the grounds.
Okay. Russ?
My definition of bad actor probably as far as, you know, the industry would be concerned. First off, I think most of them are good actors in it, but I would say on the list ought to be included if you have a standard oyster lease and you violate the requirements and conditions and your existing regulation 4 VAC 20 335 30, that I would consider a bad actor, among other things such as harvest outside of your lease area, unless it's baler grounds that are open or something. But I think those would be things I would consider a bad actor.
Okay. Anybody else? Tommy, Mark.
Well, I think Russ taught part of it, but I'm waiting to see if the industry said it. I think a pretty substantial bad situation is leasing bottom with the, in essence, to get the right to dredge it. There, I mean, I know the commission has had people come forward in the last couple of years in the York River, insistence they plan to do traditional bottom planting, and there's no, and Shell, and there's no way they did it. Apart from the fact that I would see them out my office window, they don't have anywhere to go buy Shell. There's oysters out there in places at densities that you can't make any money off of unless you dredge them. And of course VMRC could choose to allow those areas to be dredged as part of the public, but the ones that are doing no planting, no propagating, essentially nothing that's on your list, mm-hmm. things here, but simply by the fact that they can put a dredge on it, are able to get harvestable quantities of oysters.
But that's within the law.
Within the law because they leased it. And we were asking what, but they gamed the system because they didn't plant or propagate shellfish.
Well, no, they harvested.
The lease law does not say that you can lease the bottom to have sole access to harvest oysters that are there. The law says that you can lease the bottom to plant and propagate shellfish. You can plant shell.
Yes, but I believe the intent of the law is it's a right of the citizen of the Commonwealth that can openly lease ground, and if there are oysters on there, that becomes their right to harvest that product.
That'd be interesting to see that. Well, VMRC's been issuing leases to folks, but I assume they've all said they, at least in recent years, they've had to say what their intent was.
Okay.
And intent's not to just
So I get really concerned if that's the definition of a bad actor. That is really difficult to, I think we're going down a really slippery slope if we're trying to have somebody stand up and defend against the commission that's making the decision or staff to say, my intent is this or this, and to then question that intent of I'm going to harvest oysters or plant shell. We're getting into something that I don't think can be done.
I'm going to hold up, Ajay. I'm going to provide some clarification from the code. So there's two different parts to this. There is the lease, and then there's the dredge permit. And for the dredge permit, it says the commission may, after a hearing, refuse to grant or renew a permit to dredge or scrape any oyster planting ground unless it is proved that the holder has planted seed oysters or shells and is using the planting ground for the cultivation of oysters. And then it says the commission may refuse to grant the permit if it appears at the hearing that the holder of the ground is a habitual violator of any seafood laws. So I think there's two things here. There is you can apply for a lease. This may be a difference of opinion. What the code says is you can apply for a lease, so I believe you can harvest some of that. If you are going to dredge on that ground, what the code is saying is that you need to put something back down on that ground. So that's just clarifying what's in the code. Jay.
What's the number?
28.2.515, for those of you who are following along in your hymnal. Jay.
The instance that Mark is describing, you know, I think this really kind of cuts to the core of the question here on beneficial use. And for me, it's really cut or dry. There is no beneficial use if you're on a one-way street for the resource. If you're not putting anything back into the resource, you don't qualify as a beneficial use. That's a one-way taking. And I think, I mean, based on the work group and our previous conversations, I thought that's where we were heading in a definition of beneficial use, was that based on even conversations last month, you were trying to discuss ways to ascertain where they got their shell and what should that threshold be for proving that you actually put shell down. I got a 2019, I think we should be able to track that stuff. I think we should be able to show what they actually put into the resource, what the investment was, and if we can't, that is a one-way use on that on this Commonwealth's resource that they are leasing.
Mike?
clarification from Mark. Were you referring to people who lease grounds solely to access the naturally occurring shellfish and not do any propagation at all? In other
words,
they lease a 10-acre thing, they go in and dredge it, and then for the next 9 years, they don't go back.
Yes, that's what I'm referring to. And
I think it's a
very significant problem currently, a very significant problem.
And I'm sorry to jump back in, but I've mentioned this twice now, and maybe Mark can share a little more on this, but the number, the percentage of ground that this was being done on was not an insignificant amount. Was it CZM survey?
Well, it's not CZM. It's funded by CZM, and it's work that Roger Mann and Jim Wesson were doing largely.
How do you capture that data?
So I'm going to ask from a logistical standpoint if you guys can speak into the mics, because we record these minutes just for people who can't make it. And go ahead. Mark.
I'm sorry. I was done. I didn't hear the question. I think there was a question.
How do you capture that data? How do you know who's going in and who's not?
I'm not the one capturing it. I think that it's probably incomplete, as I've heard them present it, but you know that those leases that have been granted in the York River and other places in recent years that they said they were going to shell, that somebody's not in the, there have been a wild harvest, that they don't have any shell. I mean, I think it's difficult to capture it fully, and I think it would be very difficult to enforce, but I think ignoring a situation that is not beneficial for the industry at large, and that seems clearly counter to the law, doesn't help the industry a bit.
Tommy, do you want to? And then AJ.
I understand what Mark's saying, and I get it, and I get what AJ's saying. And one of the things on this list that we just got is shell turning. So I mean, that there's definite instances where people are legitimate and they're shell turning. And who's to say, I mean, I know that's a big controversial thing in the public fishery, but on private ground, shell turning can be a good thing. But I totally get what Mark's saying, and I know some of the bad actors, some of the people that are just going out they strictly went in to get the lease, and there's no way in the world they can even come up with enough shell to show all the leases that they've got.
Mike? Okay. So I think there's, and I think this is going to happen quite a bit as we go through this, there's sort of two ways to get at ensuring that the lease is at the highest and best use. There's the beginning of the process, so before that's ever even leased, and there's the end of the 10 years. And so as I hear people talk about sort of how do you prevent some of that, how do you prevent someone getting a ground and just going and just dredging it or harvesting it, putting no shell down, that's a little harder to capture in the beginning. We can talk about use plans. We can talk about some of that. That may be something we can catch at the end, which is if you know, what method did you use? If you dredged, where's your proof that you put shell down? I mean, some of this may be as straightforward as if you're claiming that you put shell down, where are your receipts? If you're claiming that if you're claiming MSX or Dermo, we're going to require tests. And some of it's just tightening up on the existing loopholes that are in the law as we look through some of this, and just requiring a slightly higher standard of proof versus, well, I did it. So those are some thoughts to have. Becky?
So that brings up a question of, in the Lynn Haven, where most of the leases are non-productive because of the water quality. What are some of the activities? And in this, you know, I'm not a oyster producer, so I know just enough to not know anything. So what are things that can be done in order to prepare it for production that may not actually be fruitful? I mean, is it just you just sit there and wait for the water to get better, or are there things that can be done? And if so, that ought to be one of the beneficial items.
I don't have a
magic answers in
the I don't know.
I mean, yeah, like Moonhaven River now, who want to do restoration efforts. They want to have a lease to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're currently not leasing ground.
Plant Shell or even Steve or the Lidhaven on a polluted lease, and hope for the best, it will eventually open. But
well, we're doing that in the leases that the city has acquired just in order to make sure that we're meeting the requirements of the lease. But I don't know what else, you know, I'm curious what that would look like so that we can monitor whether people are actually doing it or not.
This is why I made the list,
mm-hmm.
to show you these are things that I've heard. See, some of these are in the code, production and planting, beneficial to an adjacent lease. But some of these things are just people, things they all have said, education, ecotourism, restoration, shoreline erosion protection, you know, all those things. I don't see why we can't consider all of those things when we're looking at a lease renewal. The question is, how many of them? What do you all think about it? How do we weight that? How important is ecotourism versus bushels and bushels of production? You know, rank these in a way.
I think what the
it's going to be. Hold on, it's going to be Ann. Sorry, I'm going to cut you off. Just to make sure Ann, Kim, and Mike. Just to make sure we'll get a chance to talk.
I'm just going to say these are great considerations. I can see numerous ones that we use in general, but I see ones that aren't on here either. I think it's a good start at guidelines, but I think it should be limited to just what we see here.
Oh, that wasn't my intent.
Yeah,
but I think that even sitting here, I might not think of all the stuff that somebody might come up with something else that I wasn't even considering. So I think this is, I don't think we should to corner or pigeonhole what beneficial uses are. I think it has to be open. I don't know about weighing or what, but I think that we need to have an open policy, because I've added a few here that we do that I don't see on here. So
I would take it a step further and say that maybe we shouldn't actually have a list, because inevitably we're going to leave something out. So to have a hard and fast list, I think does put us into a scenario where somebody might say, I do something else with the lease, and say, well, the commission says, well, it's not on the lease, it's not on the list, don't fall in there. Now, you could say, and other beneficial uses, and leave it as such.
Kim, and then Mike, and then Russ.
And I would echo those comments and only say that it's a slippery slope to make a list and be hard and fast to a list, because I could probably say ecotourism would not have been on this list 10 years ago. And for the future development of the industry, we just don't know what a future beneficial use might be.
First, I don't understand why ecotourism needs a lease, but that's
okay.
Neither here nor
okay.
There. I actually broke my thoughts on beneficial uses into three topics, three subjects. Obviously, there's sub-items under each one. One is propagation, two is environmental services, and three is education. And I think those three broad categories capture everything in your list.
Russ?
Yes, I see on here it's about two-thirds of the way down, directly related to and beneficial to production of immediately adjacent
mm-hmm.
production grounds. Is that like, you know, I understand why the industry big players are using triploid moistures a lot of times, and you know, I understand disease problems and all that, or I know they're an issue, but if you know, diploid seeding looks like it ought to get extra credit or something, and it ought to be considered, you know, a higher level of beneficial use, in my view, just because it's going to propagate, you know, some not only on-site but off-site areas, if that's what we're trying to do. So, you know, if you're using triple weight, you know, you're seeding, you're harvesting, you're seeding, you're taking out everything you're putting in,
mm-hmm.
basically with diploid, at least, you know, notwithstanding disease problems and all that you run into, at least you're putting something into the system that might have its perpetuate the benefits.
Mark?
Mine is a question, I think, to staff. First of all, because I think Ann and Kim and Mike made really good points, is that, I mean, that you certainly wouldn't want to put a really restrictive list into regulation, but you have it could be quite flexible if the list was put into just some of the guidelines mm-hmm. that staff used and that could be put before the commission, because it's easy to change, it's easy to add. I don't know how you could anticipate such a comprehensive list that you would want to put it in the regulation. But if you could do it in guidelines, perhaps it could avoid the problems that the industry pointed out.
So the intent right now is guidelines. At this moment, we're not pursuing regulations for this or for other things. Given the new nature of this and the desire to be flexible, I think what we were looking to do, though, in providing a list that says, you know, Andrew just suggested it says guidelines say may include. The reasons for renewing a lease may include. But as Ben goes through this and he can talk to it far better than I can, we already sort of have a list like this. We're going to apply some criteria. So I think what a list does and what a guidelines do is it provides transparency to show that this is what we're looking at when we do this. There's always going to be a category of other factors that if something weird comes up, we can look at this. But what this offers is some transparency and some consistency amongst staff as the agency moves forward. Because this is not just as this group of staff applies this. We really want consistency in 5 years and 10 years and 15 years because that gives you all regulatory consistency, which is important to us. So you're not just at the whim of a few staff. You have a sense of what's going on. So I hear that you all do not want a list and you don't want a hard and fast list. But I think also the flip side of that is if it says may include, it also gives you a sense of the criteria that you are going to be evaluated on because at the end of the day, we will have to have something. I think I saw a couple of hands up. I think Ann had her hand up, and then Becky, and then Mike.
It's okay.
Okay.
So I was just going to say that it also could help as you're getting these applications where they don't put anything, where they don't give you enough information. It's kind of a source to prompt them to think about how they are actually using it. So it may be beneficial just in the application process. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate Russ's concern over diploids and triploids, but I would hate to see us try to delineate different levels of beneficial use. It's beneficial, period. Not because it's diploids or because it's triploids. It's propagation, one way or the other. To try to give one of these little items more weight than any of the others, I think you're going to leave yourselves open to a lot of criticism as well. Fall under the law.
Okay.
So I'll jump in here to defend my list. You read the top sentence, this is 10-year lease renewal guideline considerations. Okay, this was never intended to be a list of exclusivity. This would always be a list of things, and I think it's a guideline document, it's not a regulation, and it would be in all of these, plus it's not inclusive. I mean, anything else. The law currently says, among all these things which directly related to and beneficial is language right out of the law. That's the reason that's on there. That's the exact language that's in the current code. There's lots of others, MSX and Terma. So it says, when considering whether there's good cause or failure to produce, the commission shall consider the prevalence of MSX, but before that it says, in addition to other factors. So these are some of these things in the list are the other factors. So that's already in the law. There's always going to be other factors. There's always going to be something that's not on this list, if we have a list. And, you know, we don't have to have a list, but it's not exclusive to whatever we settle on a month from now or 3 months from now. This is the list. If you're not on this list, talk with your head, you know. I will listen to anything anybody puts on the form. And this is an education thing because people didn't have to do this before.
This was not the way we reviewed them, at least the way I reviewed them, based on what's in the code. There's some exceptions in the code. I definitely would consider those if you put them on there. Now we have some additional exceptions of 1205, and we have the benefits and impacts of shellfish aquaculture, which is kind of an open-ended, what is that? So I have even more things I can consider now. So that was my intent here. It wasn't to create a hard and fast rule. And my point of this was the sentences, two paragraphs below that. These are kind of the 10-year renewal things we have to look at, some of these. And there can be considered beneficial use, particularly to the leaseholder, you know, who's growing oysters. But some of these might actually conflict with the overarching public trust beneficial use, best use of a lease, because there's piers and SAV and there's other, you know. So that's the reason I got this. I gave it to Ellen and said, you can give this to them or not give it to them. It's up to you. But I did this over the weekend because I was just thinking about it. I said, you know what, I'm thinking about it. I'm going to write down a bunch of this stuff. So that was my intent. And I'm not really trying to defend it. I'm just trying to explain it, what I was thinking when I did it.
Kim and then Jay.
So, Ben, the example you gave us earlier about somebody tried to renew four leases, you approved two, denied two. If you had these guidelines, that person would have, I guess where I'm trying to get at is they didn't give you enough information.
That's the problem.
Or any.
It wasn't that they needed to pick some of these. They just didn't give me. When they gave me enough information, I was comfortable with doing the lease.
Okay.
And they said, well, you know, I should have said, well, I wish you had, because I wouldn't have sent you that first letter that said I'm not going to renew your lease.
And is that common practice when you get renewal applications? Is that they, a lot of times it's just...
Yes, and as I told you last month, you know, only was denying like 6%. And
yeah.
The vast majority of those people didn't return the form at all. And they usually call me, too, mm-hmm. and said, oh, yeah, I didn't get the form. Yeah, I did something. But of the few that I did deny that just didn't really put down much of anything, few of those just let it terminate. Obviously, they just realized they didn't do anything. They were admitting it, and they were going to lose the lease. But a small percentage would call me and say, I don't understand why you didn't renew my lease. And I'd say, well, here's why.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, what? Tell me anything you did on this lease related to propagation of shellfish. And then they would say, oh, well, I turn the shell every other year. Why didn't you put that on the form? You know, getting the shell back up to get a natural strike is something I'll definitely consider. So
if guidelines... Just follow up. So if guidelines were something that at least is on a piece of paper, when someone goes to renew their lease, I did that.
That's kind of my intent, because I think we really have to re-educate, not industry. you know, y'all get it, you know.
But it was an industry member, I'm assuming.
It was an industry member, so maybe you don't get it, but.
Right.
But the law has changed, and we've been told the way we're supposed to administer this law has also got to change. So my view is more information in the public, whether it's industry or just a guy that has a couple of leases and it's a hobby. You know, he needs to understand.
The education process.
Right. That these are all things we can consider and more, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Russ?
Yeah, these are beneficial use type. You know, possibilities, I guess, for the, you mentioned impacts earlier, too, that went into the code. So were you thinking of using, I guess, that checklist you distributed seemed to have, you know, focused more on impacts types of things. I guess it would, but you're considering, you know, this is beneficial use, but you're considering impacts too, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So the checklist is... Our internal checklist is meant more to capture not these things, because I want the person to put these things on the form, and I'll assess them. But I look at every lease, and I look at the map, and I say, are there any piers? How many piers are in the lease? Is there SAV in the lease now? It doesn't mean I'm going to necessarily deny the lease, but that triggers me to think, okay, there's other things going on here.
You're going to look
at a lot of recreational use.
there's SAV, might be a problem. If we don't, while you can dredge a lease with SAV, we prefer you didn't, but you certainly are not supposed to put cages on it. So they're telling me they've been putting cages on it all along, and it's had SAV on it the whole time. That's a separate issue that I got to talk to them about, moving the cages. But, so, yeah, I mean,
okay.
But that's not something that just, the person tells me.
Yeah,
I have to do that.
Just clarifying. So, thank you for
that. That's part of your public trust review.
Yeah, thank you
right.
for that.
And I think you had your hand up a while ago, and I'm...
Jay did. Jay's been...
Yeah, but I think I'd missed Ann first.
I was just thinking that as long as they come to you and offer up what they're doing, and you're not offering up the guidelines or a checklist to them saying, did you do any one of these?
Right.
kind of thing.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
I would like everybody to understand there are things in here maybe that they did that they don't understand apply.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure that someone would think ecotourism does apply.
I think
your argument might where that is a legitimate thing. But, I think somebody that's putting a bunch of shell or trying to build a reef or doing a shoreline erosion project and putting a lot of shell on it, and then they have a lease too, they would say, well, part of the reason I'm doing this shoreline protection, you know, I'm trying to grow oysters too, but they might not know to put that on here. And I would consider it.
Jay?
I just wanted to say this whole conversation again started as a way of making it easier for Ben to be able to weed out bad actors. And so I don't view this list as comprehensive, but without some transparency for the public, you always be open to criticism. And so by having something there as a placeholder for what is actually going to qualify you for a renewal, you insulate yourself. The fact that we had, you know, Hank 2 meetings ago saying, I've recommended that something not get renewed, and then the commission just went a different direction. Well, maybe if they had a little bit of guidance in front of them, they would have a better sense and be able to uphold a staff recommendation like that. And so that's kind of the way I view this. I don't see this as a limiting factor, but I also think without something public facing and for the commission, I don't know how you do get at some of these bad actors. So it's got to go both ways.
Tommy?
I'm concerned about significant and reasonable. Those words, I don't know how you apply them, but what is significant and reasonable for me now is going to be totally different when I'm 74 in 10 years.
Well,
my reasonable and significant is going to go way downhill.
Well, I hope I'm able to do it. Hey, this is my dilemma for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
However long I've been doing this, renewing leases. That's what the code says.
Oh, okay.
The commission shall not renew or extend assignment when there's been no significant production or no reasonable planting of shell. That's what I'm working under. That's what the law says. I don't know how to quantify that either. You know, we came up with a bushel of effort per acre per year over 10 years. That was a very low bar. Just reasonably, right. What does significant mean, and what does reasonable mean? I don't know what it means. I mean, I know what it means. You know, the common sense thing.
Yeah,
but
what it is, but.
But I'm the guy. I mean, I'm the guy that's making this
down. But 10 years from now, you may not be the guy.
I definitely won't be doing it 10 years from now.
We're still in discussion about that. But that actually is something to consider. Is that as we talk about this. And this is a broader challenge for the agency. You know, we have a lot of institutional history and knowledge now, and that is, it's hard to account for the breadth of that, the breadth and the depth of that. But in 15 years, when Ben's probably gone, this has to be, as I mentioned before, this has to be transparent, this has to be consistency for us and for you all. You don't want to just be at the whims of a single person, or even Ben if he's having a bad day. There needs, not that he has this, but this is really to get at some consistency. And so, and also, as what Jay said, some consistency with the commission. These are recommendations that staff will make, but in the past, the commission has said, no, we're going to continue to renew that lease. So what we have heard in previous meetings, and to some extent from the working group, and during the conversations with the General Assembly, is that it was the will of the industry more broadly to try to tighten up on renewals and to try not to just renew everything that comes across. And so that is also what we are trying to do. And so there's a very tricky spot here where we're trying to find these criteria to deny renewals. And that is that was the purpose of this change, was to deny ground, or to ensure that it's in its highest and best use. But to be more blunt, it is to deny some. And so how do we do that in a fair and equitable manner and in a transparent manner so that everybody knows? But I think the next question as we move to this is, if you determine that you're on that list or other factors, what is reasonable, what is significant? So Becky put her hand up, and I think it's an important point to come back to from Tommy.
It brought to mind one of the other bad actors, types of bad actors that we talked about in the stakeholders work group. There was a gentleman who was in a waterfront construction business, and he said that there were barren leases that had not harvested anything, where they were extorting people when they were trying to build piers, and it was significant, he said, like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get a pier that extended beyond 100 feet, because you had your first 100 feet, and then after that, so if all you're propagating is piers and trying to get money off of that, then you ought not be able to, I think, renew.
And that's what some of this is trying to get at, is how do we show that? If you didn't harvest anything, if you didn't do anything, and you are just extorting people for peers.
And how do the people who are being extorted let you know that?
That's a really good question. Mark?
Ben, I wonder if you could speak a little bit to what you have water quality improvement here, and what would be the measure of that? How would something only be water quality improvement and not be one of several other things on this list?
Well, I put it down because that's come up, is that, you know, people say that, you know, I want to get a lease because I'm going to save the bay. You know, I'm going to plant a bunch of horses and filter the water. It's going to improve the water quality. I don't know how much weight. How I quantify that? I just put it on this list as a possible.
First and foremost, would they be wanting to? Would the activity that they would be trying to do to improve water quality, would that need to be planting shellfish? Could you get a lease for some other means of improving water quality? It doesn't sound to me like it could.
The only reason we lease oyster ground
is to propagate shellfish.
So can I respond to that? The City of Virginia Beach is partnering with the Army Corps of Engineers on a water quality project, and it's a $10 million project. And in order to gain the control, in order to have the grounds necessary to reserve, there was no way to do that. We couldn't get easements or anything. We had to acquire oyster leases from someone who was willing to sell them. So the city is holding them because we're partnering with them. So the city acquires the real estate interest, which is the lease, and then at some point we turn it over to the federal government to do their project. But it's to build both habitat and oyster reef. And, you know, we've been trying to figure out what the long-term game plan is. Like, at some point, is it a sanctuary reef, or it becomes, you know, something different than it's not something that anybody would expect that there would be harvests from. It would just be trying to restore the water quality in a very sick river.
The water quality in the code under 1205?
Yes.
Number five.
Yep.
But as it stands now, the water quality is not tied to any demonstrable item. It's your judgment that shellfish production in that case would filter the water, that checks the box for water quality. There's no associated testing. There's no real design element to it. It's just we think shellfish would improve water quality, correct?
I would say that's correct. But I'll give you an example of the opposite. So we had a lease in Perogatang Creek, and the gentleman, he wanted to put floats, but he could have wanted to do cages. And of course he could do cages, but the question would be, if you put too many oysters in a water body that doesn't flush well, you can actually degrade the water quality to the pseudopspecies and everything else. So, you know, I think it's, we can look at it from both perspectives. You know, should we lease this new piece of ground to a person where there's already so much production in this creek that it will actually be detrimental? I think Ann might address this with clamming. I think on the shore there have been some limited circumstances where too much clam, too many clams in one creek were not a good thing. Lack of food and you know, so it can be self-regulating by industry, but it's something we could look at too for both new lease applications and for 10-year renewals. It's just causing a water quality adverse impact. So it is hard to quantify the problem.
It's more quantifiable than some of them. People just don't always want to know what the numbers are when they crank them out the other end.
Well,
might not be as much for quality improvement as they think.
And Russ?
If it's actually somebody trying to grow something and you put too many, whether it's in the creeks on the shore or if it's around, the animals are going to tell you.
Yep.
They're going to either live or die. So you're going to have your answers pretty quick with your harvesting reporting. So, I mean, that's pretty, I mean, I don't know if you guys need to
self-regulate.
So I don't know how much effort you have to put in. But I think water quality is an important characteristic to keep in the guidelines.
Russ and then Tim?
I think with water quality, a big thing is the big M, management. What kind of management's being used? Does it fit, you know, the circumstances Ben's describing? You know, you could use certain management practices that would work in those situations and may be beneficial versus in others. Other management practices be detrimental. So I think there's, you know, benefits. It can be benefits to water quality. It can be detriments to water quality. And not only depends on the site and the circumstances, but I think the management and how that interfaces.
Ken?
I just wanted to comment that this very conversation that we have going on right here leads me to think that renewals are extremely subjective and on a case-by-case basis. I mean, we've heard right now just the pros and the cons of water quality, and I think you could do that with a number of these on this list. So I'm not sure I understand exactly where you're trying to go and understand the reasons why, but I'm also hearing it literally is on a case-by-case basis that maybe one size doesn't fit all.
So, you know, the commission, the board, really struggles with situations where they're eventually, we're talking about denials, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you will be talking about appeals. And free time, the board really doesn't like to be faced with too many appeals. It makes it very subjective there as well. And so, although Ben and company might be able to do a great job on the denials for good reasons, once that gets to the board, it's going to be entirely different, to the point where the board, which they've done with other situations, is going to ask, aren't there ways that we can avoid these appeals coming to us? And that's been the status of the appeal situation. One quick example, which has nothing to do with shellfish, but with crustaceans. So in 2009, there were appeals on crab licenses that were lost that lasted from January till June. And out of 865 individuals who lost their license when all the smoke cleared, there were probably about 260 because the commission just did not want to be caught in the middle of that situation. So I would surmise, based on a conversation of here, that the list can work both ways. Even if it's guidelines, it can open the door for the commission to be able to, you know, not take the staff recommendation based on, you know, criteria, which a lot of you would know are pretty flimsy, but when it comes down to denying something, that makes it tough on the commission. So you have that to look forward to. I agree with you, Kim, on what you said. Not only the, you know, the reassignment situation is going to be pretty tough. And Ben said earlier that there are already exceptions built into the law, so that percolates right on through the process. So.
So they are individual, you're right, it's a case by case. I try not to be subjective in a way, you know, I try to be fair, okay, to each person with what they put. I try to be consistent. But with the way the law is written, and adding the impacts and benefits of shellfish and 1205 factors, there's a lot of things in there. Yeah. There's a lot of moving parts in there that I don't know how you quantify those in a systematic way. So.
But the law does state no significant production, no reasonable plantings. So how do we as staff determine significant or reasonable? That's in the code. It's something we're supposed to use, and when some of these denials get a hearing or appeal, the commission's going to look to staff and look to us and say, what do you mean by reasonable or significant? And so some of this is just, it's questions that are hard to answer, but I think we will need to try to at least put up some parameters just as we move forward on this. Ben has currently been using, what's your standard?
One bushel of effort per acre per year.
Per year.
And that includes planting, harvesting. So she's right. That's the law. The law says significant and reasonable. We're currently using half a bushel of effort per acre per year. We think it's pretty low based on how the public grounds manage. But there are a lot of big leases where it might be difficult to hit that. Then if you can't hit that, then those other sections get hit. So they're kind of like secondary. If you don't have reasonable plantings, if you do, it doesn't matter if you had MSA, you know, we're going to renew your lease because you've had reasonable plantings or reasonable or significant harvest. So while this list sort of considers, you know, other things you have done, they're kind of the other factors. My view is still the primary part of the law is we want you to have significant and reasonable, significant production and reasonable planning. If you don't, tell us why you couldn't, or tell us what else, something else you're doing. You know, and we had this discussion before. I mean, what do y'all think about the bushel per acre per year of effort? Is that crazy? Is that?
First of all, I think it's way too low for a reasonable industry participant. But I see us getting into a huge quagmire here because what is reasonable and significant for a 2-acre lease is not the same for a 10, 20, 50-acre lease. And to judge a 50-acre lease on one bushel of effort per acre per year and a 2-acre on that same metric is totally wrong. That's just the only way I can put it. It's just wrong.
That's where this is a conundrum because if it's a 200-acre lease and it's got some really good spots that are really productive, that's 12% of the lease. You know, you probably can't hit this. You may not be able to hit this threshold. I don't care how good you are. That's when the other factors has got to kick in, and you got to say, well, I have it as a buffer to keep other people off my lease. These things are spotty. You know, to encompass them all, I need the entire acreage because they're kind of, if you put that on the form, You may not hit the bushel per acre, and I still would renew your lease. But again, it's every single one is, and I think this law also makes it difficult, or it makes it difficult for me to, how do I factor a recreational lease or two? Somebody's got a couple of leases, and they don't sell any oysters, but they're growing oysters, and they're harvesting some for their personal use. It's almost like a recreational lease, but we don't have such a thing. So you're right. Size does not fit all.
I have heartburn about trying to provide metrics for you to use. I understand that it would be great if you had a checkbox, you know, 5 acres, and he did this much, 10 acres, and I did this much. But you just described a situation where the person is totally legal in what they're doing because they're getting their 2 bushels an acre a year for Christmas and Thanksgiving for the family. They're not selling a thing. They're propagating and they're harvesting. Is it significant harvest? 2 acres, 2 bushels a year is not a significant harvest. But is it reasonable? For that person, it is. Putting metrics on the guidelines, I think, is going to be a real slippery slope. Because then, how do you determine what is education? How do you determine what is restoration? How do you determine why ecotourism needs a lease? So, I'm just very hesitant to go down the metric slope.
Right. Well, and we came up with that, one, just to have something as a placeholder for now, and two, I think it was a fruitful exercise to go back and look at last year, using 1 bushel of effort per acre per year.
Well, that's what you used to get the number.
I went from 6% to 40%.
Yeah.
With what everybody, I think, most of y'all would say, that's too low. I mean, for reasonable, significant production, a bushel of effort a acre per year. What? And I didn't factor in people that would call me and say, oh, yeah, but I did this, this, and this, these other factors. So it wouldn't have been 40%. It would have been something less than that. But you can see, just losing that low of a threshold, how much it would have jumped. So, you know, that's a conundrum I'm in.
Russ and then Jay.
Yeah, I think a meeting or two ago, you told us about the 1 bushel thing, and you said it was related to, you did some analysis of harvest from open baler grounds,
well,
I believe, and it was it... Was that per acre of the acreage open in that particular year, or was it brought across all baler grounds in rotation, or how was that derived?
If you want to sort of break it down, I guess, in roughly 240,000 acres of public ground, only about 75,000 is open every year, 75,000 acres of that, not including the seaside there. But basically, just sort of rough math just to come up with a number that's comparable there. You know, the annual harvest since 2014 has been between 240 and 300,000 bushels. So that gave you more than that 1 bushel of acre per year, even though all of that ground isn't always open to harvest. So that was just sort of a comparable, the vast amount of
across all baler grounds. So it's, I think it's a guideline is what you're talking about. I think it's reasonable to have something. I'd personally rather people planted the oysters and didn't harvest them. So in terms of that, you know, it looks like the way the law is worded, it allows that because it's significant production or reasonable seeding efforts and that sort of thing.
Correct. Significant harvest or reasonable plantings.
Yeah.
Jay, did you have your hand up?
I get everyone's reluctance to have something concrete here. Nobody wants to get caught up in a situation where it is not explicit that what you're doing is protected. But the flip side of this is there's nothing explicit that someone taking the viewshed lease is doing something wrong if you don't have a metric. There's nothing explicit about the fact that whatever this ecotourism lease is that Mike has some concerns about. If there's no metric for anything,
it's very difficult to come back and say this is a spite lease, and they say no, it's not. I get oysters out every Thanksgiving. It's difficult to say that this person took a view shed lease, that they were just trying to keep aquaculture from being in front of their house. You gotta. Said this a couple different ways now. You have to make a determination at a certain point that shellfish production is sort of a best and highest use here, and that has to have some line in the sand, even if it's a very low bar. Because if you don't, you have no leverage to come back on these troublemaking leases. There's absolutely nothing you can come back and say that they're doing wrong if everyone's argued that there is no standard. I mean, we have a lot of things you can do, but without a delineating line, it makes it nearly impossible to say that they're not meeting the bare minimum for one of these things. And that's, you know, I feel like we've gone around this conversation a number of different times where everyone says, you know, surely we need to find a way to weed these people out. And then everyone flips and says, well, I'm concerned that would do have an impact to me, but then we come back and say, well, you've got to find a way to weed them out. It's a bare minimum. You have to have some kind of standard, or you can't. You can't have it. You can't end up having it both ways, because right now our default position is that Ben will take care of everybody, and that's great. I believe in you as well, but it is not a long-term management system. That can't be our long-term management system, that Ben doesn't get to retire and we'll always make fair decisions. And that's currently what it is we're saying we don't want to lock anything in. We trust that Ben will make the right decision for us here, and we'll take care of these troublemaking leases because we've made it clear. But what happens when he retires? What happens when you don't have a governor that is from the eastern shore of Virginia? What happens when you get a Northern Virginia governor who finds it very appealing that someone should be able to take out a view shed spite lease? There's no precedent without a guideline or some kind of something on paper for commission members. And I feel like the concerns about a slippery slope right now need to be balanced against the long-term institution of MRC and what they're doing to manage these leases, because we're running into a period in which there's a big question mark over management. I mean, eventually, Ben is going to leave us. So.
Well, hope everyone will
sounds so grim.
Whenever I leave,
MRC, like that, they got real grim at the end, Jay. Get real grim.
Well, no, I appreciate you saying that, Jay, because what I would like to do when I leave is leave something someone else could handle. You know, it's set up in a way that you don't need the institutional knowledge that unfortunately I've gained over the last 30-some years. I do have some. I'll admit that. You know, I don't know that I say that I know it all. But if we could get a system in place that someone can come in that's reasonable and administer it and not flounder, because this is difficult. For my job, this is the hardest part of my job, I think. It's this renewal of leases, and now new leases even, with the law change, looking at them more robustly with all the new factors of the code. It's a very difficult thing, and anything you could provide to us, me, to help make this process more transparent so that you don't feel like if I have a bad day, you're going to get denied. And I won't be here, you know, in the future. And so I'll get off my soapbox.
I'm sorry, just with apologies. The traffic has, I have no option. I have to leave. I have child pickup to do before they put him out of the street.
Thank you, Mike.
In any chance of different times of the day for the leave, given that some of you got here a little bit earlier, but I had a 30-minute delay in traffic.
It's tough here all the time.
Agent.
So I heard a lot of, you know, the comments about production, and we're looking for a standard and somebody can take it over and understand it and things like that, and heard the concerns about putting quantitative measures to this. but I just want to take a step back and say that if we put a quantitative standard in here, whatever that number might be, it might be one bushel per acre per year, you are going to eliminate some growers. However you define grower, might be a very small grower. You're going to eliminate somebody. I mean, you just said it went from 6% to 40% for each lease. So you're going to eliminate somebody. So if you're putting a standard on it, you're eliminating somebody in the industry. So
yeah, and
you have to understand that. And there's just one follow-up. Is Virginia's a leader in the industry. We all recognize that on the East Coast. And there are production standards in other states. And those states have a very small shellfish industry. And there's a reason why. They either have really high lease fees, or they have a lot of fees on them, they have permitting problems, or they have production standards where there are some industry members that can't meet that. So I just think we need to be really careful. Mark was talking about water quality, for example. Well, you know, you might not want to know the metrics of water quality because, you know, at some point in time, the water quality deteriorates. It's not an improvement. It's a detriment, right? Well, okay. Then what happens to sanctuaries? We have a lot of sanctuaries up in a tributary, sub-estuary system, and you're not harvesting anything. Well, guess what's going to happen? Water quality is going to deteriorate. So should we not have sanctuaries? I mean, there's so many things that when we start talking about quantitatively assessing things, bushels per acre, water quality, oh, we can do the water quality test. Well, we're really going down a road, I think, that's very difficult. I think what needs to happen, and we said this with the application fee, is raise it high enough where people are going to think twice about getting into the business or expanding or whatever they're doing, where you are going to actually have them come to the podium and discuss in front and defend what their plan is in front of the commission. It's the same thing for lease renewals. There has to be some time that you're going to, be it Ben or the next person, is going to say, this lease has, I don't understand the criteria that are being written down, I need somebody to come here and defend it in front of the commission. And something's going to have to be made an example of. It's been done in many other fisheries. License revocations, come here and defend in front of the commission what the reason is.
And I think that's good food for thought. I think it still circles back to what specifically with license revocation, we have a very clear matrix of, like, if you did this, then thou shalt happen. And I think what, in the situations, because the only way to really bring it before the commission is to deny. And so and that person requests a hearing.
Correct.
And the commission is going to say, Ben, or, the person formerly known as Ben, like, why'd you deny it? And Ben's going to have to say, here's why. And Rob, we were discussing this draft regulation, Rob made a really good point, is that it's really hard for the commission because it is nine people, to grapple with loopholes. Because it's not, I can't imagine, it's not fun to sit up there and take somebody's lease. Like, that's not a fun position to be in, I can imagine. Nor is it a position I think the commission really wants to be in. And so the more loopholes we give them, the more outs we give them, the easier it becomes. And that's not, I'm in no way, shape, or form critiquing the commission. I think that's just human nature. If you want to be generous, you want to give people the benefit of the doubt. The reason we have the matrix, and even then, you still see a lot of deference given in terms of, here's what you absolutely can do, but maybe we'll give 6 months probation versus a year, or 6 months revocation and five years probation. So there's still wiggle room, but that still starts with some criteria, some standard.
Standard.
That's a good word. I think someone else's hand went up. Maybe not. People are flagging. So I'm looking up. Becky and the Jay.
I just have a question.
Yeah.
So if they couldn't meet that significant production based on, they have a really large lease and they're only using part of it and they don't have some sort of, something else on this list that is satisfying you, and it gets denied, it's then open to then have them reapply for a smaller lease, wouldn't it be? So, I mean, it may be a way to just right-size some of them. I mean, I'm I'm always interested to hear what you know, the industry thinks, but since it isn't modifying, you know, you don't have the tool to modify, maybe the denial is just a step in the modification process. And so you're not really taking away a lease forever. You're taking this, you know, 200-acre lease and letting them apply for a 100-acre lease.
Jay?
I'll hold off for now.
What Becky just described, though, you don't do. If someone, if you deny a 200-acre lease, you don't come back to them and say, okay, I'm denying your 200-acre lease, but if you would reapply for 25 acres of it, we would consider giving you that 25 acres back. That's not something that you currently do. No. Nor do I think it would be actually legal and fair, because when a lease becomes vacant, anyone can apply for it. First come, first serve.
We do modify applications.
Yes.
Yes, we will modify applications.
Modify applications.
Right.
Not renewals.
Not renewals. Renewals. Not, it's not come out.
And the code now says we can modify a transfer.
Yeah. Right.
But not renewal. Take a 50-acre transfer request and say we're only going to transfer 25 acres. So many peers or the SAB. I mean, you have to have some reason, but we could. Done it yet? Anybody, but.
But that could, I mean, if the person wants to appeal it to the commission, then your recommendation could be we're recommending it to be denied or only reapply for the ground that they're using.
Well, that's what I'm suggesting. I mean, I would prefer that if it had some sort of modification language in the code, but if it's not there, then it really is either one of two things. You either have to meet the significant production or show some other beneficial use, or you run the risk that you're going to lose all of it and can't be the first one in line to apply for it. And speaking, you know, as someone from the city of Virginia Beach, where we have acquired portions of leases for the purpose of something that is not predominantly production. I mean, we're doing the production, but only because we have to. You know, we're doing it because if we don't own it, when somebody else gives it up, it's wall-to-wall leases. There's nowhere for a channel. So we have to hold it and do whatever it is that we have to do, but I don't even know if that's going to wind up being beneficial use. I mean, in my world, in my preference, it would be have some other way to protect that land that isn't, it shouldn't be an oyster lease. But if I don't hold one, then somebody else can come and apply for it. So, you know, and then I have to pay somebody else for consent to dredge through. So, you know, that is kind of a gap in the system, is there is no other way in order to protect it until, you know, the channel is really there. And so once the channel is there, then you can refuse to reassign it. And so I, you know, my hope is that those types of leases shouldn't be renewed because you shouldn't need to. You should have your channel there by the time the 10 years is up. But until the, you know, the, we have a documented history of that, I'm going to be reluctant where we paid value for that in order to maintain that right, that we would just let it go abandoned and let somebody else come in there. And I'm open to hearing other solutions to this problem, but that's kind of the one that we're wrestling with.
Other thoughts?
It's too bad you can't modify it anyway. That's what I understand if it's not in the statute.
It is a question we were, in previous conversations, we're going to pose to our attorney to see what, yeah, what the options might be. I mean, I think there was two questions there, that do we have the legal authority and is there a broader political appetite to be able to do that? So if your options are I lose 200 acres or I get to keep 100 acres, but that is more deference given to staff and given to the commission. So we also just didn't know sort of what the general sense would be in terms of if that would be okay.
It could be beneficial to, I mean, one, it gives the agency flexibility to deal with issues, but two, it would seem preferable if you got to carve a small piece out of a lease, but you can renew it versus, you know, deny the whole thing and have to appeal it and all that.
sort of thing. So it's interesting.
It does give us more options, something we need to flag, we need to ask our attorney about. Any other 515, we're sort of winding down. Any other thoughts or questions or comments? This is, gives staff, excuse me, a lot to think about as we try to rough out some sort of guidelines. Mike?
Does the full commission approve guidelines? I know that when we did the SID protocol, it went before the commission.
That's been our process, to bring guidance documents to the commission.
And that's the intent with these as well. We are not doing full regulations, but we are looking for commission-approved guidelines.
So eventually, if these go to the commission as guidelines, it will be public hearing. It will be the whole process.
Yes. It will. There will be public input. This is not, and that's to improve and increase transparency.
Sorry,
I heard you say you didn't like that.
So. Yeah, I'm sorry, under my breath.
I heard it too.
Am I the only industry person up here groaning?
No.
Okay,
no.
Thank you. I think it's really, I understand what Jay is saying. I understand your dilemma. But as an industry person, having these set in stone guidelines or VMRC, and I understand your dilemma from your perspective, but we're missing something. We're missing the boat somewhere. There has to be something for transparency that is not set in stone guidelines for VMRC. And I haven't been able to materialize what it is, but having these guidelines is going to cause more issues, I think, than not. I'm not saying that the $150 renewal fee is going to take care of a lot of the issues that you're dealing with for the next couple of years, but having these guidelines set in stone, we're not going to capture what we need to capture.
Becky and then Jay.
So a lot of the times in the law and other areas, the way that they handle this kind of thing is they include a list, but then there's sort of an open-ended, an other category, which would be of similar nature. And so it's not meant to be an exclusive list. It's meant to give you an idea of the types of things that would be looked at favorably or considered. And to me, any guideline list would have to be that, and I think that's what you're intending it to be. But there's no other category on here. I wrote it in, but to me, just because it's going to be changing, and you would find, you say that every single one is different then, and so every time that somebody's going to apply, they might have something that's compelling. It does continue the subjective nature of it, but whoever is going to be doing this job forever, for the next, or the next people are going to see the same patterns or are going to be able to understand the quality and nature of what the other, whether it fits or whether it doesn't. I know putting it in writing makes it sound more strenuous, but I do think it would help for some of the industry folks who don't have a prompt in order for them, when they write it in and would get an automatic denial because they didn't put anything in there. So in some ways, I think it's beneficial to have it for the industry, not speaking for you. I can just see how that would benefit. But in another category, I think, would be.
Like Pirates of the Caribbean. It's not a rule, it's a guideline.
Sorry, I moved you up. No, that's actually a pretty good one. Jay?
I would just say maybe that's something for industry to talk about internally then if, as Ann said, if she can't put it in words yet, maybe there's another way to get at this. I'm not prepared to say I fully endorse this list approach. The point I'm trying to make here, though, is that I, hearing you say I need to have a system I can pass on, implies we don't have a system, and that makes me very uncomfortable. I think what that has been beneficial for a very long time, because we've had an agency that's been intimately familiar with our industry folks, that everybody knows each other, gets along, works with each other, can have an informal conversation, but that is not, that does not give you surety moving forward with a government agency. And that is what I'm concerned about. I agree with AJ's point. We have the best aquaculture industry. I think we will for a long time, but part of that means making sure that we're looking to the future and making sure that there is some guardrails in place to ensure that our aquaculture is still going to be number one, and that it's not going to go off the rails because we have a change in culture all of a sudden, and you can easily get a spite lease for Viewshed. So I think I just would encourage everyone to have a conversation internally that if there's another way to get at this, wonderful. I'm not married to this list, although it's a really good start of a list. But I do think we've got to talk about some kind of guardrails here.
Okay. Last thoughts, comments, or concerns? So the next steps for this is, like as I mentioned, for the $150 renewal, we will likely take that before the commission to request a public hearing. This meeting is June. And then staff's going to sort of go back and begin and think through the comments and concerns that were raised today and try to figure out how we can better start to sketch this out. And the hope is that the next time we meet, we will have something roughed out for you to look at. As I look at the breadth of these comments, sort of the task in front of us, that may mean 2 months. It may take us a while to really to think through this, and I think we want to do this deliberately. And I would rather skip a meeting and bring you something that's better fleshed out than bring something sort of half-baked and waste people's time here and travel time. So we'll go back as staff and try to figure that out, but we will let you know very quickly if we are going to try to bring this to you in 2 months, and that's when we would reconvene if we're going to try to do it in another month, if that is okay with you all.
You're going to try to get this regulation on the June agenda for a July public hearing?
Correct. For that, yes. But for the broader conversation around guidelines and beneficial use. The other thing that we did not talk about today, which could be something else we consider next time, is, as I mentioned, there's sort of two ways to get at ensuring beneficial use. There is the end of it when we're looking at renewals, and then what is the information we request from people at the beginning of the process in their lease application, and we didn't really get to that today, so that could also be a conversation for the next meeting that we have. But as always, we thank you for your time and your thoughts and your input to this process, and if you have any questions, you can always reach out to any of us in between now and then. AJ,
so you had a list, I think, in your email about the other meetings, being July, August, whatever. So you're saying the July one might skip over, depending on your work?
Yes. It's also very much the will of the committee, because we have both this to consider, and then, as I just mentioned, sort of how do we capture some of this at the beginning of the process and not just the end, which may be different criteria.
So I think that would be...
So that may be what we come together in...
August, then.
Yeah, if we don't meet in July, we'll discuss both of those things in August. But we will look at it. All right. Thank you all very much for your time. Hopefully, I think it stopped raining, so it'll be a little drier leaving. Thank you all.
I realize that.